And good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, whatever the case may be on this rotating planetary sphere known across the galaxy and down through time as planet Earth. Actually, it's not known as that. I don't know what it's called out there. I mean, even the name Earth, which means dirt, is not the technical name of the planet. I believe it's Tellus, and I think that's Latin, and maybe that also means dirt. Anyway, no, Terra means dirt. Tellus is the planet, and that's a long story for another evening. We're going to be doing some different things tonight. My guest, of course, is Dr. Richard Spence, and we're going to be exploring the origins of this really unique experiment in self-government called the United States of America. And we're going to take you back hundreds of years to the discussions and maybe false starts of several different iterations of what eventually became the United States. And we're going to do that in a very interesting way because, as you know, Rick is a great storyteller and he is a heck of a teacher. And I can't wait to hear us get into it. Before we do that, I wanted to go through a couple of news items and then give you some data points to kind of put the rest of the evening's discussion into context. First of all, it's very hard these days to kind of find any good news. I mean, it's really hard to find good news. For one thing, the mainstream is filled 24/7 with COVID-19, which after a while, you know, A, is incredibly overwhelming and oppressive because there is no good news on that front. We've got, you know, over a million of our citizens at the actual measurements, and there's probably many, many more who have come down with this thing, and over 65,000 people in this country alone have died. And, you know, for all those people out there who say, oh, the numbers are exaggerated and it's no worse than the flu, you talk to some of these nurses or doctors, or that doctor the other day who went home to Virginia and wound up killing herself because she's seen so much death. And the thing that really bothers me the most is that all these people are dying in hospitals alone. They can't have their families with them. This thing is so contagious. And I know everything I've just said is wildly contentious and controversial, and there are other points of view. And again, when in history have we all argued over, you know, basic facts? Facts should be, as I think it was Jefferson who said, unshakable or immutable things. It's stubborn things. That's what he said, stubborn things. We're no longer even agreeing on the same things. And again, in the third hour when George joins us, our resident metaphysician, we're going to talk about some very important philosophical perspectives as a kind of a prelude to what I'm going to do tomorrow night when I have the extraordinary honor of having Dr. Joseph Farrell as my guest. And we're going to be talking about some things in relation to this global situation, the pandemic, which are so far outside the box, we can't find the box. But I think we owe it to you to lay out on the table even the improbable, because this is so strange and so weird. Anyway, we're going to get into the weirdness factor and the outside-the-box thinking tomorrow night. Tonight, I want to talk about the country. I want to talk about what this is doing to the land of the free and the home of the brave, because it's just so weird. And to kind of set this up in context, I found this a couple days ago, and unfortunately I can't tell you who it's by, who it was written by, or I can't even tell you the author's name, the narrator. But it is so emblematic of the aspirational nature of the land of the home of the free and the brave. And so I wanted to play this tonight as a kind of a context. If you kind of cast your mind back, I think this may have been written maybe in the 50s or 60s. It has that flavor, but it's a story that almost nobody knows about an event that everybody knows about. And here it goes. So relax and listen and think about where we have come from.
There was a lawyer once. His name was Francis Scott Key. He penned a song that I'm sure you're aware of. You've seen it. It's in most hymnals throughout our churches. It's called the National Anthem. It is our song as an American. We go, however, to a ball game. We stand in our church services and we sing the words of that song, and they float over our minds and our lips, and we don't even realize what we're singing. Most of us have memorized it as a child, but we've never really thought about what it means. Let me tell you a story. Francis Scott Key was a lawyer in Baltimore. The colonies were engaged in vicious conflict with the mother country, Britain. Because of this conflict and the protractedness of it, they had accumulated prisoners on both sides. The American colonies had prisoners and the British had prisoners. And the American government initiated a move. They went to the British and they said, "Let us negotiate for the release of these prisoners." They said, "We want to send a man out to discuss this with you." They were holding the American prisoners in boats about 1,000 yards offshore. And they said, "We want to send a man by the name of Francis Scott Key. He will come out and negotiate to see if we can make a mutual exchange." On the appointed day, in a rowboat, he went out to this boat and he negotiated with the British officials. And they reached a conclusion that men could be exchanged on a one-for-one basis. Francis Scott Key, jubilant with the fact that he'd been successful, went down below in the boats, and what he found was a cargo hold full of humanity, men. And he said, "Men, I've got news for you tonight. You're free." He said, "Tonight I have negotiated successfully your return to the colonies." He said, "You'll be taken out of this boat, out of this filth, out of your chains." As he went back up on board to arrange for their passage to the shore, the admiral came and he said, "We have a slight problem." He said, "We will still honor our commitment to release these men, but it'll be merely academic after tonight. It won't matter." And Francis Scott Key said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, Mr. Key," he said, "tonight we have laid an ultimatum upon the colonies. Your people will either capitulate and lay down the colors of that flag that you think so much of, or you see that fort right over there, Fort Henry?" He said, "We're going to remove it from the face of the earth." He said, "How are you going to do that?" He said, "If you will, scan the horizon of the sea." And as he looked, he could see hundreds of little dots. And he said, "That's the entire British war fleet." He said, "All of the gunpowder, all of the armament is being called upon to demolish that fort. It will be here within striking distance in a matter of about 2.5 hours. He said, "The war is over. These men would be free anyway." He said, "You can't shell that fort." He said, that's a large fort. He said, "It's full of women and children." He says, "It's predominantly not a military fort." He said, "Don't worry about it." They said, "We've left them a way out." And he said, "What's that?" He said, "Do you see that flag way up on the rampart?" He said, "We have told them that if they will lower that flag, the shelling will stop immediately. And we'll know that they've surrendered. And you'll now be under British rule." Francis Scott Key went down below and told the men what was about to happen. And they said, "How many ships?" He said, "Hundreds." The ships got closer. Francis Scott Key went back up on top and he said, "Men, I'll shout down to you what's going on as we watch." As twilight began to fall, and as the haze hung over the ocean as it does at sunset, suddenly, the British war fleet unleashed. He says, "The sound was deafening. There were so many guns that there were no reliefs." He said, "It was absolutely impossible to talk or hear." He said, "Suddenly the sky, although dark, was suddenly lit." And he says, "From down below, all he could hear the men, the prisoners, saying was, 'Tell us where the flag is. What have they done with the flag?'" Is the flag still flying over the rampart? Tell us. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours into the shelling. Every time the bomb would explode and it would be close to the flag, they could see the flag in the illuminated red glare of that bomb, and Francis Scott Key would report down to the men below, it's still up. It's not down. The admiral came and he said, your people are insane. He said, what's the matter with them? He said, don't they understand this is an impossible situation? Francis Scott Key said he remembered what George Washington had said. He said, the thing that sets the American Christian apart from all other people in the world is he will die on his feet before he'll live on his knees. The admiral said, we have now instructed all of the guns to focus on the rampart to take that flag down. He said, we don't understand something. Our reconnaissance tells us that that flag has been hit directly again and again and again, and yet it's still flying. We don't understand that. But he said, now we're about to bring every gun for the next 3 hours to bear on that point. Francis Scott Key said the barrage was unmerciful. All that he could hear was the men down below praying. The prayer. God, keep that flag flying where we last saw it. Sunrise came. He said there was a heavy mist hanging over the land, but the rampart was tall enough. There stood the flag, completely nondescript, in shreds. The flagpole itself was at a crazy angle. The flag was still at the top. Francis Scott Key went aboard and immediately went into Fort Henry to see what had happened. And what he found had happened was that that flagpole and that flag had suffered repetitious direct hits. And when it had fallen, but men, fathers, who knew what it meant for that flag to be on the ground, although knowing that all of the British guns were trained on it, walked over and held it up humanly until they died. Their bodies were removed and others took their place. Francis Scott Key said what held that flagpole in place at that unusual angle were patriots' bodies. He penned the song, "Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? Or the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that the flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet fly and wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?" The debt was demanded. The price, it was paid.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the pale fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rock
Dr. Richard Spence is professor of history at the University of Idaho. His interests include Russian, military history, along with espionage, occultism, and anti-Semitism. His major published works include Boris Savinov, Renegade on the Left, Trust No One, The Secret World of Sidney Reilly, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult, and Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1925. Richard is the author of numerous articles in Revolutionary Russia, Intelligence and National Security, the Journal for the Study of Anti-Semitism, American Communist History, The Historian, New Dawn, and other publications. He has been interviewed on numerous programs and is a commentator and consultant for the History Channel, the International Spy Museum, Radio Liberty, and the documentaries produced by the Russian Cultural Foundation. Richard Spence, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight.
It's my pleasure, Richard. Here we are.
Well,
Saturday.
You know, when I ran across this, I said that is something you've never heard. The context of the creation of a meme, of an ideal, of an aspiration. We have drifted so far from that meme. What happened?
The interesting thing about it is that the thing you just played presents itself as the true story of the Star Spangled Banner, right?
Yeah.
And it isn't. I don't want to disappoint anybody or disappoint you, but, you know, I'd have to say that it's not historically accurate. Okay, I got to rain on your parade. And the main thing that struck me was that the fellow's talking about the colonies, right? It's the British, and they're working with the colonies. Well, the Star-Spangled Battle, the battle that's referred to, I think he mentions, is the Battle of Fort McHenry, which was a small part of a larger Battle of Baltimore. And it took place in 1814. Didn't take place took place during the War of 1812. When the United States was already established. So there were no colonies. Okay? The colonies were not involved with this. It was the United States of America and had been for years. The interesting thing about it, though, is that the War of 1812 that this particular incident took place in is, I would argue, we might get into it later, I'd argue that the War of 1812 is the real American War of Independence.
Hmm.
Because it secured an independence which had been legally recognized back in 1783, but had never really been enforced in many ways. So, yeah, it didn't take place in the colonies. It's not part of the Revolutionary War at all. It took place, during the War of 1812, in fact, in September 1814. And unfortunately, it makes a much better story to say that there were hundreds of British ships. You know how many there actually were in the Battle of Baltimore?
Probably two or three.
Well, more than that, 19.
Oh, you mean
so 19 ships.
Hmm.
Yeah, so there were 19 warships, and they, in the battle itself, inside Fort McHenry, there were not piles of dead. Four were killed. And
really?
20-odd wounded. Yeah. So it was a fairly ferocious bombardment, or as one as you can get, and the flag was still there, and the British did not secure Baltimore. They had previously burned Washington, D.C., but they did not secure Baltimore. Because, you see, in 1814, Washington, D.C. was an unimportant city, and Baltimore was important. There's one of the things that's changed.
Well, Baltimore was the port, right?
Yes, Baltimore was a city. I mean, it was one of the few things you could probably qualify in early 19th century America as a real city, and it was an important port. Washington was a relative, remember, it was a new creation. It was a city sort of, you know, created in a swamp. It was the center of the federal government, but as a city itself, it was really kind of a Virginian provincial town. I mean, it is not what it became later on. So from a military standpoint, that's the way to think of it, from a military standpoint, the capture of Washington and the burning of the White House had a psychological value, but Baltimore was what you really needed if you wanted to be able to supply an army. So there you go.
Hmm.
So it's the thing about this, though, is that, well, I don't know. Let me tell you a story to get back to this one, okay?
Okay.
And it has to do just with a kind of – one of the things
– See, this is why you're the historian and I'm not.
Well, being able to connect things is part of this, sometimes even if they're not really connected. But, you know, having a lot of time on my hand, or, you know, spare time, or at least being stuck at home, I've been watching old movies. And one of the things I've wanted to do is take advantage of my Prime membership and Netflix. And so I've been watching movies. I won't name them because most of them aren't very good. But they're ones that I haven't seen in 50 years. All right? You know, at least probably that. I'm old enough to have ever seen a movie 50 years ago.
Wow.
And these are movies that I remembered, and the reason why I'm rewatching them is that, I don't know, I'm trying to relive my youth or something. But the interesting thing is that every time I watch one of them, I think I remember that movie, and I don't.
Oh. Huh.
All right? I mean, there are parts of it I remember, but I find that you know, here, I'll give you an example. There is a 70s kind of schlocky but not that bad spy movie called The Kremlin Letter. All right?
Okay.
And I had remembered seeing that, and I went back.
Who was in it?
I rewatched. Well, it was directed by John Huston, had Patrick Neal, Richard Boone, Barbara Parkins. See, I just watched it so I can remember some of them. I mean, you know, it had John Huston at the helm of it, so it wasn't a low-budget production, but a very complicated kind of Raymond Chandler plot with a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought I remember, and I'd actually carried some of these scenes around in my head for years, you know, the type of thing you kind of remember and you replay them, and it wasn't anything like that at all.
Huh.
I mean, it was, I was watching a movie that was, yes, the movie I recalled in some ways, but in other ways, I was realizing that my recollections of this were skewed. And it's one of those things that I've seen in other cases as well, even, I mean, films that I think that I have clear memories of. I don't have clear memories of them. I don't think it's just me. And part of it is that's what time does, what it does to individual memories and what it does to collective memories of things. And so the interesting way I can kind of segue this back into the Star Spangled Banner and the War of 1812 and the Battle of Fort McHenry is that, you know, in the rendition that was just given, I'm sure that the performer of it, the person who wrote that, thought that they were putting forward the true story or something that they had heard. And it, again, it's one of those things that bears a kind of approximation to what really happened, but it's not really at all what really happened, and it's not when it happened. And that, from the standpoint of an historian, is kind of scary.
Hmm.
But it also, in some ways, points up, because it means that what you're trying to do as an historian is not go back and reassemble pieces of things. I mean, that's often what people, you know, they go back, you know, history is a kind of, you know, fallen cathedral, right? All right, you think of history as this sort of, and what historians do is they go back and they reassemble the cathedral, they reassemble the Roman Forum. And,
yeah, we look at a lot of ruins around here, so yeah, I can see that, yeah.
And but you can't really do that. I mean, it's constantly changing. As soon as an event occurs, within the individual and collective memories that experience that over time, it will change and it will shift, and little bits of it will combine with something else. And so very often what we remember is not truly what happened. And then we can begin to impose certain things. You know, so the Battle of Baltimore ends up, you know, happening in the Revolutionary War instead of in the War of 1812. It becomes a much bigger battle than it actually was. It still, you know, doesn't change the fact that the poem and ultimately the song, The Star-Spangled Banner, came out of that. But the circumstances itself shift and move. So historians always want to think that what we're trying to do is to recover and analyze the past. You know, let's put it this way. What historians do in some ways kind of analyze what happened. But in order to analyze something accurately, you have to be able to assemble it accurately. You have to have an accurate picture. And that can be a very tough thing to do. And I think that we're always, you know, as much as anyone tries, it's always a difficult process. It's a kind of painstaking process. But the main thing is that it's an imperfect one. Because I don't think, as hard as you try with anything, that you can ever really perfectly reassemble the past. You can get close to what was there, but you're always going to get slightly different versions of it, if that makes any sense.
Makes perfect sense. The reason that I was captivated is because it wasn't the details, and I went and checked one of their sources. Mm-hmm. They did list the Smithsonian, so I kind of thought, well, I'm probably on firm ground. No, it wasn't the detail, it was the atmosphere, it was the theme, it was the aspect. It's what, in this recording, what the current president of the United States did to get elected. He told a story, he laid out a vision, and a third of the country and the majority of the Electoral College went for it. And he's been doing that for 3+ years now, weaving stories, weaving a narrative. He talks about being optimistic. We're in the midst of this extraordinary, you know, whatever it is, and he's talking about being optimistic. It's that, not history, but the atmosphere of history, that I think that really communicates of a time when we thought of the United States of America as that exceptional country, that regardless of what will happen, we will come through. The dawn will rise, and we will still be here with all our values intact. And that's a great uncertainty right now. Anyway, let me pause, because we're going to try another experiment this morning. We're going to be doing repetitions from different artists, different orchestras, different times, of a song written by Woody Guthrie back in the 1940s. And as we go through the evening and morning, I'll tell you more about it. In fact, we actually even have a link I'll put up to give you the backstory of perhaps one of the most interesting contexts of us, of the United States, that has ever been written. In fact, some people have said that this, as opposed to the Star-Spangled Banner, should in fact be the national anthem. This is Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
The Other Side of the News is a current and dynamic companion to augment the discussions from the other side of midnight.
We investigate, explore, and extrapolate facts to gain better understanding of current affairs and events, and thus
to bring comfort and calm to our wide international audience. It's a spontaneous commentary
based on well-verified references vetted through vigilance and discernment.
Our desire
is to awaken your imagination
with questions.
Questions that have not been asked, yet need answering. The Other Side of the News is a place where you can come and be with us in community.
Learning new things, asking questions, getting compelling answers,
and interesting viewpoints. It's about curiosity.
We present thought-provoking questions to incite your mind, propelling you to see the world in another way.
Propelling you to see the world in another way.
With clear insights. Fresh perspectives on global events.
Tune in for a balanced view
of the other side of the news.
A song that makes you think you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I'm out.
Here comes Lady Gaga. And I wasn't really paying attention, but, you know, she started singing one of my dad's songs, and it was like, well, what? I called my sister. I said, turn on the TV. By the time she did, it was over. Lady Gaga didn't do the whole.
I'm out to sing the songs that make you take pride in yourself.
As I went walking the ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, you
Black Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I've roamed and rambled, I've found my footsteps to the sparkling town.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, May 2nd. Gosh, the year is whipping by. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence, and we're discussing the origins of this unique experiment. Richard, is it fair to call the United States a unique experiment?
Well, for the 18th century, it was unique. It wouldn't necessarily be now. I mean, it was unique in the sense it was creating a kind of republic from scratch. The question then, what kind of a republic was it going to be? I mean, there's a tendency to, and I want you to keep in mind, I'm not trying to debunk or dismiss anything, which often is what, you know, when you're trying to get back to what actually happened and what was going on at the time, often seen, you know, it's again turning a battle from hundreds of ships down to 19, but it gets you back to the point of what that starting point was. And the United States constituted itself as a republic. And in the 18th century, those were very few and far between. And it was also a term which had different meanings at various times. So, you know, the republic itself, the concept goes back to Plato and his idea of a republic, which if anybody's ever looked at Plato's republic, it's not much of a republic. It's, well, you know, it's ruled by an elite. It's essentially an oligarchy. So the ancient republic of... So one of the things that, let's say, here's an interesting example. When American patriots in the late 18th century imagined creating a new republic out of a collection of colonies, they had a kind of historical model. I mean, first of all, they had that word. They don't invent the word. The concept of republic had been around. I mean, Venice, medieval Venice, had been a republic. We wouldn't recognize it as such. But they had the word, and they imagined that in a different way than it had been applied before. So they, you know, one of the things they were trying to connect it to was the glories of the Republic of Athens. So really, even by 18th century standards, the Republic of Athens would never have been recognized as any such thing. I mean, Athens was, you know, first of all, a relatively small Greek city-state dominated by a few powerful families. Only about a third of the population was capable of casting ballots, and only the male members of those. So when you really got around to it, in Athens, basically nobody had any say in anything. But it was nevertheless the concept of republic. The concept there wasn't how many people had a say, but that really there should be a kind of collective decision-making. Maybe that's what it really was. That the ancient concept of a republic wasn't based upon the concept of what proportion of the population participated, but that it wasn't rule by one person. That it was a collective rule of some larger community of people, even if they only constituted a small minority, the overall population, that there was some kind of collective agreement that had to be brought together. And that was the big challenge for this new American republic, as to how that collective, that system of collective self-governance, that collective agreement that would have to be based upon, you know, how would you would manage that? Because it sounds very easy to say that, well, we're all going to work together, okay? This is what we all like to say. We're all going to work together smoothly. We're going to bring everybody. We're going to include people. We're going to bring in different opinions. And that all has a very good sound to it, but it isn't necessarily very effective. Because
The more... Didn't kings, I mean, even King George and all those folks, they have, like, privy councils? Didn't they have cabinets?
They did.
Didn't they? In other words, so there wasn't one... autocrat, he kind of, or in cases like we go back to ancient Egypt, you know, Hatshepsut, you had a group of insiders that gave advice, and then the king or the principal guy or the you know, whatever, made the final decision, which is kind of like presidents now and cabinets and all that. But it was not, I mean, wasn't the unique idea that the Republic in this experiment was to represent the great unwashed, the people themselves, the citizens, the folks that did everything but made a country even possible. Wasn't that the unique idea?
Well, it was to try to include, in theory, as many people as possible, or the whole, let's say, adult reasoning population should in some way be involved.
Which were men and landowners and that kind of thing.
Right. British monarchs had, you know, they had a council. They also had parliament, keep in mind. And by the way, back in the 1600s, the British Parliament had already, in the English Civil War, established who had real authority when they cut the king's head off. That again is one of those things that's often forgotten. We all remember the guillotine and the French cutting off a king's head, but people tend to forget that more than 100 years earlier, the British had decapitated a king in a political showdown with Parliament. And Parliament established its, if not its supremacy, certainly its equality with the king by killing him, and then later by reestablishing a monarchy. So monarchs, you know, the idea of, let's put it this way, the concept of absolute monarchy is as much an historical fallacy as the concept of absolute democracy, okay? Neither one of those things, with maybe rare exceptions, have ever really existed. But the difference would be that what, in theory, what both Parliament and Privy Council, what all the king's advisors were doing, is that they were advising one person, that one person set above everyone else. So one way to think of it is that the parliament, with its many, many members, might in fact overthrow a king. They might kill a king if that would be necessary, but no one individually or collectively in that body was the equal of the king. Only the king, or in some cases the queen, was the monarch. And everyone, I mean, this is one of the differences between, you might think of it as of a republic like ours and a monarchy, and it's still the case today. No one actually has British citizenship, right? If you're in the UK, you are not a citizen of the UK. You are a subject of the Queen. That's what it is that binds you together. That is the common thing that links everyone within the realm, is that they are subjects of the monarch. And that still carries, in the British context, if not necessarily a lot of real political power, it carries a great deal of symbolic power. And, you know, politics is all about symbols. So the idea, the thing that the American Republic was struggling with, is how do you represent everybody? So in the place, here's the difference. Instead of having the monarch, the king or the queen, which in some way is a reflection of us all, That's the theory, at least, you know, that the monarch is more than a mere human being. They become the kind of physical embodiment of Britannia. You know, the queen becomes Regina. She's not, you know, she's not a woman anymore. She's not, you know, if anyone who's really interested in this, if they haven't seen it, can take a look at the series, very good, called The Crown.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is a not a fawning appreciation of the British monarchy, but it is revealing in some ways of the concept that, you know, the queen or the king of the states they really have no life of their own. This is one of the they have to kind of play this character.
Well, doesn't the British system kind of separate head of state, which resides in this embodiment of the nation, of the people, the queen, in this case Elizabeth, and the prime minister, who's really the day-to-day go-to guy to make government work? Smooshed into one guy or one woman someday, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between head of state and head of government. So the government, you know, is whatever elected political officials, whatever sort of parliamentarians are running the government bureaucracy, what are in charge of the bureaucracy of the state. And they come and go. So there are elections, and elections establish majorities in Parliament or in Congress, and on the basis, you know, and in the parliamentary system, the head of the government is always the head of the majority party or majority faction in Parliament. And I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing. We can have a president from one party, and we can have Congress controlled by the opposite party. Mm-hmm. In a parliamentary system, you can't really have that, because
You have ministers, and then you have the prime minister.
Yeah. Okay. And the prime minister is the closest approximation to a president. He runs the government, but he has to be approved by the monarch.
Mm.
So this is one of the things that I think that series makes very, you know, one of the powers that the British monarch still has is that every person who is named prime minister has to be okayed by the queen.
What happens, or the king. And has it ever happened that he or she has said, nope, not him?
Yes, but not often. Oh. See, that's one of those things that would create, as they would call it, a constitutional problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a way, it's a formality. I mean, and here's why.
Well, it's all custom. It's all the norm. It's legacy. What's the word I'm looking for?
Well,
custom.
It's custom, but it's also probably why the British monarchy has survived where others haven't, because one of the things is that you stay out of politics. See, this is why whenever someone in the royal family publicly expresses a political opinion about something, that is a no-no. Okay? You are never – I mean, first of all, if you're a royal, you don't vote, or if you do vote, you never talk about it. You never express your views on political issues, because that makes the monarchy political. And when you make it political, then it gets aligned with one party or one faction or another, and then someone gets angry at you.
And this extends to the entire royal family, right?
Yes, and you're not supposed to do anything which would politicize or to create controversy. The theory, the idealized version, is that the monarch, and by extension the royal family, is above that type of thing.
Mm.
Right? We are above politics. We, you know, the queen reigns as the monarch of Britain. The people are her subjects. She does not belong to the Conservative Party or the Labour Party. And you see, if you had someone, if a prime minister was sent forward and the monarch refused to appoint them, that would be a political action. Then they would be taking sides.
Mm.
Then there would be hell to pay in Parliament. So it's not to say that it couldn't happen, but from a political standpoint, it's one of the things that you would want to avoid.
Well, I guess as an historian, I was asking, has it ever happened? Do we have a record?
I think it's happened in the 19th century. I mean, British parliamentary history isn't not too up on that at that point. Because the minute you do that, you've thrown down the gauntlet.
Mm.
I mean, look, you can't have the majority in Parliament send their candidate forward to you, and if you reject them, well, yeah, they can just keep sending them back, or they could send someone else. But you at that point have created a controversy with Parliament. You have rejected theirs. I think the tacit rule is that, no, you really can't. But the important thing is the symbolism that even if you as the monarch absolutely hate this person, if you think that they are the worst person that could possibly, if you can't stand them and you can't stand their politics, the important part of symbolism is that they still have to come to you literally hat in hand and ask you to pat them on the head. All right?
Mm.
And that's this kind of dance that's developed in this. I mean, it's all about the, again, it's about tradition, but it's not just kind of following blind tradition. I mean, there's an important symbolic sort of interplay of power. That the monarch's power is in many ways latent.
Okay? Mm.
The monarch has powers that they don't use, because to use those powers could create a political confrontation. But on the other hand, there is a tacit respect that those powers exist. So again, if the idea was that the king or the queen was simply a mere figurehead whose opinion didn't matter on anything, then why would you send your anointed prime minister for them to receive approval?
Hmm.
Because that's the way the system works. That's the thing that kind of binds state and government together.
In a country which has no written constitution.
No. The Constitution is basically just the sort of legal precedent of everything which has been done up to that time. And is apparently one of the few things, at least up through Elizabeth II, that British monarchs were ever educated in.
Hmm.
I thought one of the most, to me, most surprising and in some ways really sort of sad element in that series is that when Elizabeth, still as a fairly young woman, is basically sent, I think they sent her to Oxford, and she's to be schooled in, you know, various sort of arcane elements in the Constitution, you know, how the government, you know, how her government works, she's instructed in.
Was this before her father died?
No, I think this is right. I think this is before her coronation.
Ah.
But she's supposed to understand the symbolic importance of what she's doing. And what she realizes is that she really doesn't know anything.
Hmm.
Because she's never, keep in mind, she's never attended a regular school. She never went to university. She was educated by tutors, but she was largely educated in matters of constitution and matters of the court.
Well, during the war, she was actually an auto mechanic, wasn't she?
Yeah. You know, and learning sort of a practical skill. But in terms of things like history and mathematics, so one of the things that she apparently realized she had an interest in was math, but she was never educated in that because that wasn't something that is queen. I mean, you know, you're queen, you're not going to have to do, you know.
Princesses don't
do that. You're
not going
to have to do your taxes, or you're not going to have to balance a checkbook, so why would you ever know these things?
Uh-huh.
And she sort of comes to this realization that she's ignorant.
Wow.
I mean, not that she's, you know, in any way, she's a very, you know, an intelligent person.
This is in 1952, just, I believe.
This is in the 50s, that she's really ignorant of much of the things that other people around her know. And one of the things, again, interesting of that, if you watch it, is that that's one of the reasons why she's sort of continuously manipulated by people. I mean, she's continually being told what she can do and what she can't do. And so an example of that, again, I may be giving too much away, is that, you know, Elizabeth has a younger notorious sister, you know, Princess Margaret.
Oh,
some
yes.
People out there must remember. And Princess Margaret was always kind of getting into trouble because, well, you know, she was the younger sister. She wasn't, and her older sister had only sons, so she was never going to be queen. So
amazing how freeing that is.
Well, it was freak. What Margaret wanted to do is that she fell in love with this. He was an RAF. I'm not going to be able to remember his name. She fell in love with a commoner, and she wanted to marry him. And Elizabeth, as her sister, you know, as Elizabeth, as Lilibet, you know, Margaret's sister, wanted to make her sister happy. And there was a. And so she goes, well, yes, you know, you can do it. We can, you know, of course, if you want to be happy. And then, you know, the members of the court come in and they go, no, this cannot happen at all. You can never allow this marriage because there is a rule. There is a rule which says the younger siblings of the monarch cannot marry without their permission until they're 25.
Mm.
Not 18, 25. And they're going, you can't, and she's not, and you can't allow her to do this because this would set a precedent. And then literally what Elizabeth has to do is to, you know, and they tell her that, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, we understand that you're sympathetic towards her as your sister. But when you're in this role, you're not her sister. You are the queen. All right. And the queen isn't swayed by such things. So she literally has to go back, and what I thought was a very well-played and painful scene, tell her sister, who she desperately wanted to make happy, she had no real, you know, reservation, but that, no, I cannot allow this. You know, that the natural order of things as they exist do not permit me to do this, and no, that cannot happen.
Mm.
Now, Margaret did have a choice. Margaret could have repudiated her royal status. She could have said, you know, she could basically have done what Meghan and Harry
did. I was just going to say, echoes of Meghan and Harry.
I don't want to play that. Well, that's why, if anybody is kind of puzzled as to why would somebody give up the wonderful life of being a royal, really, it's not all that wonderful of a life. Because you're governed by all of these rules, and you know, they just said, we don't want any more of this. And, you know, and Margaret could have done that. She goes, I don't want to be Princess Margaret anymore. I quit.
It reminds me of that story about Mark Twain that he told one time about being ridden out of town on a rail after being tarred and feathered. And he said, well, if it weren't for the honor of the thing, I'd just as soon pass it up.
Yeah, it's... So, yeah, see, that's another one of those things. If you imagine, you know, the old saying, you know, uneasy is the head that wears the crown.
Yep.
There are also just a lot of rules. You have, it's just constantly. No, I think it's one of the things that comes across is Elizabeth, much of her life was simply being told by people that whatever she wanted to do, she couldn't do.
Sounds to me like I should be adding this to my list of binge watching.
Yes, I think it's definitely worth watching. There's a very interesting portrayal in there by an American actor, actually, of John Lithgow plays Churchill.
Oh.
In a way that I've never, you know, it's Churchill very much towards the end of his life and political career.
Mm-hmm.
Still a very forceful and scrappy guy, but not, you know, a different kind of Churchill than is usually portrayed. But yeah, you know, coming back to the Yankees, you know, who were Englishmen up to a point until they decided they didn't want to be.
By the way, if you wonder what's going on in the background, that's our coyotes here in the Land of Enchantment tonight.
Oh. Oh, I did hear one, yeah.
And as soon as I said that, they stopped. They used to come and serenade Morella.
Ah.
That's real live coyotes in the desert.
Well, make sure all the doors and windows are shut.
They're all wide open.
Plates of raw meat laying out. So
anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So the concept in the United States is that sovereignty resides not in the monarch, but it resides in the people. Okay. In this concept of the people. So there are the American people. And since the American people have rejected being subjects of a monarch, they have to have other principles to unite them. Because being all the common subjects of the monarch is very important to...
Hey, Richard, I hate to cut you off, but we're coming up on the top of the hour.
Yeah.
Hard break. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We're going into a rather lengthy and interesting discourse on the origin of the United States. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out.